Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, with my co-host, Delilah Jones, president of ImaginePublicity.com, welcoming you to another edition of Shattered Lives for enlightenment, education, and entertainment this evening. And I have to say that this evening we have a very, very special topic and special show, in fact, a groundbreaking show of sorts. We are going to be talking about the topic of human trafficking, and specifically sex trafficking, with a very special guest. And I will bring in Delilah in just one second, but I just wanted to let people know, to kind of give a little bit of a framework. Our guest, in part, is on the show because he's hoping to promote a very good conference with respect to introducing human trafficking and sex trafficking to the Charlotte area, and with the Area Health Education Center. And just to let our listeners know so they get a reference point, I was given information that Charlotte is one of the top 10 cities in the nation on human trafficking, that human trafficking is one of the world's most profitable and fastest-growing criminal enterprises, as we know. And it's estimated that an average of 16,000 individuals are trafficked across U.S. borders each year, and approximately 25% of those victims end up in a southeastern United States, including North and South Carolina. So with that framework, I have to say that this is a very, very important topic. And I'd like to bring in my co-host, Delilah. It's so nice to have you on board, as always. What's on your mind this evening?
I'm just I'm very excited about our guest and very interesting topic, you know, with sex trafficking. We've talked about sex trafficking and human trafficking, labor trafficking, all sorts of trafficking before on previous shows, but this is from a totally different standpoint for the listener's benefit. This our guest is also known as Mr. Madam, and we will be hearing about his new books coming out and, you know, his background and how did all of this get going in his life and how did he change and turn everything around. So it's, you know, it's an exclusive that we were very lucky to get. He apparently, you know, hasn't so-called come out yet in public. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is a very big deal for us.
I think so, and I feel very honored to have been a part of it. I have to say that, you know, if someone does not have the most stellar life but does everything they can to redeem themselves and tries to pay it forward and do the right thing with crime victims, then I think we're morally bound to give that person a voice, and that's what it's about this evening, you know. Just very, very briefly, I'll give you a little bit of an encapsulated bio. John Pace founded World Class Events Management when he was 19 years old and led a company for over 25 years. His community projects have included being president of Honda Capital City Classics and Procter & Gamble Ohio Classics. He was in marketing for the sports and entertainment industries with some very prestigious companies, as well as serving as a marketing consultant for some very high-level companies such as Brown & Williamson Tobacco Company, Nabisco, Coca-Cola. And he's also served as a government liaison and a number of different things across the country for several years. And then lo and behold, he changed his life and went to the dark side. And that's what we're going to hear about as well. And I'll John can bring us up to date. John, thank you so much for appearing on Shattered Life. It's a pleasure to have you this evening.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Donna and Delilah. And thank you for your courage. It takes courage to have a guest such as me with my past on the show. All the time, listeners aren't sensitive to how I can help. They focus on the dark past. And so thank you for exhibiting courage.
Well, thank you. We don't shy away from controversy because I think anything that helps us to educate our audiences, we'll try as long as it's not against law. Okay?
Yes.
So it's great to have you. And there's so many things that I'm curious about as, you know, the average Joe or Joanne, as Delilah likes to say. But why don't we... so that our audience can get a better understanding sequentially, why don't we go back to your background prior to Mr. Madam and talk about your background with respect to what I just read about with your marketing, excuse me, in entertainment and the sports industry. What was that like? What were your specific duties with the large corporations that you worked for?
Sure.
And how'd you get involved in that?
Sure. I was born and raised in the heart of the Midwest, Central Ohio, raised in a fundamentalist evangelical Christian home. My dad was an apostolic Pentecostal bishop. My mother was a minister. And so we were raised in a very fundamental Christian home. I left home before I was 18. I went to college because my parents told me I had to. That lasted less than a year. I dropped out of college to pursue my dream to be the next Don King in 1978 at 18 years old. Mm-hmm. And so... chasing that dream, I was able to build a very successful enterprise. My company owned over 20 sports and entertainment properties that we produced at NFL and NBA venues across the country.
What was that company that you started and worked for? I mean, can you name it? I mean, would we know
world it? World-class events management. World-class events management was the company. And so I built that company. I invested all of myself in that company. And along the way in building that company, I became fully vested in winning. I didn't know it at the time, but as I look back on it, I was more concerned with winning than being successful. And so to win...
What do you mean by that? Can you explain that?
Sure. What I mean by that is the competition. You know, I was always a small fish in a big, big ocean. And so I looked at those around me as my competition. And as I look back, I needed validation. You know, growing up, I knew that I was loved, but I didn't feel loved. I didn't feel appreciated. And so as I moved into my adulthood and started building my company, validation became very important to me. And so the way I validated myself was beating the competition. And later on, it even became important for me to beat what I had done yesterday. So nothing was good enough. But the only reason why I was motivated to win was because I wanted to show everyone that I matter. I have some value. And as I progressed and got older, I found that validation by buying stuff. So I had to have the $500,000 house to say to everyone, I am a winner. Didn't enjoy the house. My wife didn't want the house, didn't need the house. But that was my way of saying to everybody, I'm a winner. I had an office that was larger and more expensive than I needed because I needed the validation of people to say, you're successful. We appreciate you. We value you. And so as I built world-class events management to win, I sacrificed all of the values I was raised with. I was competing for advertising dollars. And so to win, I would entertain executives at strip clubs. I was able to establish a relationship with some of the top exotic dancers. They're less respectfully called strippers. I call them exotic dancers. But I established relationships, and they helped me win all across the country. And so eventually I got to a point where whatever an executive wanted, I would provide, no matter what it was, legal, illegal. I was able to provide that. Now, let me say for the record, the majority of executives I worked with were honest, hardworking men. But there is a small percentage of them that can be manipulated, that can be seduced. And I took advantage of that. So I built that company for 25 years, and we were doing over $1 million a year. And I'd gotten married in 1998, and so by the time we got to 2001, my wife really wanted me to settle down. She wanted a child, and so I thought to sell the company. And so I became really aggressive about building the company sales, building the company's net worth, et cetera, et cetera. And so in doing so, in 2001, I made the decision to embark upon the largest event the company had ever done. We were doing a football bowl game at the new Cincinnati Bengals Stadium, where the Cincinnati Bengals play, Paul Brown Stadium. It was a brand-new stadium. And the game was going to be nationally televised. It had national championship implications. And so we had built that event. It was a whole week-long event starting on Monday, and the game was going to be on that Saturday. Well, we were already successful by that Monday, but on that Tuesday, the planes hit the tower. It was 9/11, 2001. And when that happened, the NCAA canceled the rest of our event, including the football game. And when the accounting was done, my company had lost well over $1 million and was facing bankruptcy. I managed to keep the company going.
So part of it was due to timing?
I'm sorry?
I'm sorry. Part of that was due to the bad timing, shall we say, with it being associated at the same time period as 9/11?
Thousands of companies closed. The little talked about story are all of the small businesses that went under as a direct result of 9/11. My company was one of those, although I was able to hang on longer than most. I was able to hang on for a few more years, but finally the debt caused by that loss caught up with the company, and we closed in 2006. St. Patrick's Day of 2006, I stood before the media with shame and disgrace and made the announcement. And after that, I spiraled downward. I had already been an alcoholic since I was 16, and so in 2006 when my company closed, I'd been an alcoholic for some time, nearly 30 years. And I went deeper into alcoholism. I lost my faith. I lost my desire. I asked my wife for a divorce because I really didn't want her to suffer with me. And so it was at that period that my downward spiral after my company had collapsed, I took all of the knowledge I had gained over the years from working with exotic dancers and escorts and marketing and the knowledge I had about lonely businessmen, how they think, how they operate. I turned all of that and my 8,000 square feet house that my wife had vacated after I asked her for the divorce, I took all of that and I turned it into what became known in the sex industry as the mansion. And so almost overnight, it became infamous. It became very infamous, one of the most exclusive, patronized houses of prostitution in the country. And so that's how it all began. I did a considerable amount of research before opening it. I wanted to understand how law enforcement operated in that community. I wanted to understand the laws of supply and demand as it related to sex trafficking and what is sometimes referred to as high-level or high-priced prostitution. So that's how I got into it.
So during that time when you said you started a downward spiral and you were, I mean, did you kind of perk up and get your act together because, oh, now I have this new lucrative venture and I'm going to do all this research and put it into this venture? Because, you know, I'm just wondering, what was your mindset and your justification, you know, during that period, you know, 2006 to start that up? Well, I have to do something to maintain my lifestyle. Is that kind of what you were saying to yourself?
Without question. And see, what I know now, I was deceived then just like everyone in the sex trade. It's a very deceptive business, and you start out by deceiving yourself. And so I should say that it took me about 4 or 5 months vacillating back and forth before I could get my morality under control or out of control enough to be able to do it. But having said that, I went through the stages that everyone who enters the sex industry goes through. And that is whether you enter it as a provider or you know, as I did as a male madam or as a female madam. The first thing is curiosity, inquisitive. You know, you want to know answers. And so two questions I've always had since I took my first executive to a strip club. One question I had is, why is she selling it? You know, mm-hmm. I was always inquisitive about why women sell their bodies. The second question I had as part of my inquisitive stage of this was, why is he buying it? I always wondered why men go into strip clubs and pour out thousands and thousands of dollars to be teased. Mm-hmm. Later on, I became inquisitive and wanted to know why men buy sex and who are these men. And so much of the time I spent in the sex trade, I was bored because I was not using my brain. I spent a lot of time doing research. Little did I know at the time, the research I was doing just to pass away the time would be used to be able to help rescue women in prostitution and to be able to battle against demand reduction. Nonetheless, that was the first stage, and it's the first stage that everybody goes through. So first, you're inquisitive, and you want to know, so you're asking a lot of questions. The second stage is excitement. Yes, you are excited. You know, it's the, you know, you're making money. It's a party all the time lifestyle. You seem to have no worries. It's not taxing on the brain. So the next stage is excitement. The third stage is disenchantment, because you start to realize that what you thought was glamorous is not at all glamorous. You start to know who these people are as people, and you hear shattered life after shattered life after miserable story after miserable story, you know, going back to everyone's childhood. And so it's disenchanting, because the glamour that you thought you were seeing is no longer glamorous. And so that's the third stage. The fourth stage is hopelessness. You know, you lose hope because now you're addicted to the fast money. You're addicted to the lifestyle. Many in the sex industry become addicted to drugs because they have to self-medicate just to be able to tolerate the clientele and the lifestyle. And so that is the fourth stage, is hopelessness. And that's the stage that we really have to contend with, is hopelessness. So that's what happened to me, and it's what happens to everyone who gets into the sex trade. You know, you go through those four stages: inquisitive, excitement, disenchantment or disillusionment, and then finally hopelessness.
Well, it seems to be a downward spiral progression. But for those of us that are unfamiliar, can you step back a little bit and describe to us just actually what a male madam does, in terms of are you making the text or the phone connections or the email connections and hooking up high-priced customers with the quote-unquote best women that you can find? What is it that you are actually doing as a male madam on a day-to-day basis, so that we can get a little snapshot of what would be your typical day when you were doing this? I know you were very good at research, and you said you were bored and you were doing, you know, illicit drugs and all of those kinds of things. But what are the hardcore functions of what you did in order to make this such a successful venture? What were the, you know, what would you do? How do you do it?
Yeah. So the first responsibility of the male madam, or the female madam, as it were, is to identify and secure a safe location for escorts to ply their trade. And that's important. And what I'll talk about in Charlotte is, today there is a movement toward a certain profile, a certain neighborhood that traffickers look for to operate in, and I'll talk about that in Charlotte. One of the things I developed, shamefully, was a profile that in the sex industry is now called the perfect neighborhood to operate a bordello. That's the first thing. That's the first thing. You have to identify and secure a safe location. The second thing is, you have to develop a marketing strategy that can bring in more customers than the escort could bring in by operating as an independent. So you have to be a good marketer. You have to be able to market her better than she can market herself. And then thirdly, of course, you go out and you recruit the escorts. Now, normally, a recruiter is a female, and that's something that's little talked about. More and more, the trend is where madams and now even street pimps are becoming female. And so, you know, you recruit and you have to explain. I didn't deal with streetwalkers. I dealt with escorts. And so they are business-minded. And so I had to explain to them why they would be safer and make more money working with me, even after giving me 50%, than they would working by themselves. And, you know, of course, I was there to protect them, not necessarily physically protect them, but I was to keep my ear to the ground, to understand the tactics that law enforcement was using, when a raid might be coming, and then again, putting them in a perfect neighborhood that minimized the probability that there would be a raid or a sting.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and
you know,
so the agreement was that they would give you 50% of every customer they got, and was this a verbal contract, or was there anything, you know, other than that, or what did you use?
It
was verbal.
And then, the other thing that's really important,
yep.
Donna, is not just
yep.
recruiting the escorts, but recruiting customers, being very strategic in how you market the escorts, you know, so You're marketing the business. You're marketing them to customers. And since the profile of the customers I served at the mansion was similar to the customers I had served in corporate America for 30 years, that came natural for me. I understood how they think. I understood their likes and dislikes. And so I was able to put together descriptions of females that spoke to their needs.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you a quick question. Where did you recruit your customers from? Did you use advertising like Backpage
mm-hmm.
or Craigslist mm-hmm. or anything like that? Or did you already have, you know, this circle of people that you already knew and were able to market these services to them?
No, I did not market to any when I knew. I made the mistake of telling one of my old customers about it, and that didn't go well. And so I did not allow, nor did I market to anyone I knew back in corporate America. I used the Internet. Now, early on when I first started, I recruited seasoned professionals. The girls who were considered to be top escorts. But I quickly found out they ran rings around me. They had far more experience, far more knowledge. They were more cunning. They were difficult for me to work with in as much as they conned my pants off, if you will.
And that you could not control them. They were going to control you.
Well, there is no control in the escort business, you know, but the thing was they knew all of the tricks and I knew no tricks. And so, for example, I would recruit customers, and so the customers would come to the mansion and date a particular escort. Well, mm-hmm. that escort then might give the customer her own personal phone number, and she would start seeing him outside the mansion and keeping all of the money. So it would be a situation where I was recruiting customers. I was spending the money and the time to recruit the customers, and they would steal
and
the customers.
She was getting the financial benefit,
So,
well, what
so
about...
at that point in time, and let me ask this, so this is important. At that point in time, I was advertising for women on Arrow's Guide and websites like the Escort Vault. These are exclusive high-end websites where you pay $200 or $300 a month for a membership. So
mm-hmm.
that was my first strategy. But then my strategy changed to where I started recruiting women who had potential, but they had no social skills. They had little knowledge of the business. They didn't know how to market themselves. And so what I did, I put together an Emily Post training session, etiquette training, social skills, how to groom yourself, you know, and we took the girls through a four-week etiquette training. And by the end of that theme, and trust, and let me say this to your listeners, because it's all about deception, and it's all an upside-down world. So when I say self-esteem, I'm not talking about self-esteem in a traditional sense, okay? But they had a better opinion of themselves as it related to their body as a commodity. So I'm not talking about a positive self-esteem. There's nothing positive about what I'm saying. So I want to make that clear. But their opinions of themselves improved greatly, and now they were able to act in a way that was socially acceptable. They were able to carry on conversations with businessmen, and they felt somewhat indebted to me for raising their status. Again, understand how twisted this is, okay? I'm not glorifying it by any means.
It's and you're developing a rapport and a relationship such that they wouldn't now turn around and go behind your back and procure those customers privately.
That's correct.
Is that right?
That's correct. It was less likely that would
and,
happen.
Yeah. Can you, you know, 1 hour just isn't enough because we've got like 27 minutes and we've got a lot of things that we would like to cover. Can you talk about the time period in which, okay, you began to be successful and you're into this high-powered lifestyle again with oodles of money and prestige and all of this now. So you get to this point, and how do you get from there? And then did some event happen where you suddenly saw the light or everything came crashing down around you? And then, you know, as you told me in 2009, you know, it sucked.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that? Because then we'd like to talk about in the later 15 minutes of the show maybe, you know, why they sell it, why they buy it, and some of your solutions.
Sure. Thank you. So remember we talked about the stages. We talked about the first stage being inquisitive, the second stage being excitement, and the third stage being disillusionment or disenchantment.
Right.
And so after I'd been in for about a year, I heard story after story after story after story that my emotions just couldn't handle. You know, an escort who was 20 years old and had already had three friends die of heroin. She had been hooked on heroin to kick heroin only to become a serious alcoholic all before her 21st birthday. The story of a cutter who was 21 years old who witnessed her mother's boyfriend kill her father, serve a very short time in jail, then move into the house. And at the time I met her, she was living with the man who she saw kill her own father and her mother, and her mother had a baby by this man. You know, stories of girls who were taken out on the streets or taken into hotel rooms at the age of 7 and 8, and their mother stashed their money in their socks because if she got mugged, she knew that, you know, no one would suspect that the money would be on the child. You know, just story after story, you know.
Horrific in the seedy side of life.
Yes. Yeah, so you see, you know, and before, when you go into a strip club, these girls look glamorous. They sound articulate. When you see escorts on television being interviewed, they look like they're in control. They're beautiful. They're glamorous. Every hair is in place. And so the disillusionment when you find out who they really are as people, and when you start to hear how they landed in the business and what their childhoods were like, So you can't be human and hear that day after day after day after day and still maintain your excitement and still maintain a positive energy. And so it just got to the point where my heart was pounded in the cotton. I couldn't hear another story, you know. And so at that point, my spirit became dead. You know, I began to die inside. And the only reason why I got up in the morning was to drink, you know. And that's the other symptom of someone who's been in the business for a year or two. They're at that stage of hopelessness. Remember we talked about the last being hopelessness. And once you reach that stage of hopelessness, the only reason why you get out of bed in the morning is to feed your addiction. That's the only reason why you get out of bed is to feed your addiction. And so I reached that point about a year and a half into it. And that was about the halfway point of my run in the sex trade. And so that was the beginning of the end for me.
And then after that point, did it continue to downward spiral such that you decided to go back to your religious roots and say, you know, I have to choose another path even though I'm going to live a very, very modest life and I have to find something better for these women? How did that happen?
Sure. I got out the same way I got in stages. You know, I was sick of it for well over a year before I was finally able to be delivered from it. During that time, I was indicted twice. The first time I was indicted, and then I was given a year probation. Well, 11 months into that probation, I got indicted again. And God began to speak to me through my attorney, and he convinced me that I was not invincible, that, John, you can go to jail. See, that's the thing. Nobody in the sex trade believes that they will go to jail. They believe that, number one, it's a victimless crime, and that's the biggest deception. That's the deception that is really feeding people turning a deaf ear and a deaf eye to what's really going on there, you know. So, it became real to me. I had a daughter who I loved, and somehow I was able to maintain being a decent father during this time, you know, during all of that. In fact, my daughter was the only connection I had to reality. Because once you get into the sex trade, you cut yourself off from everyone who's not in the sex trade. I reached a point where I had gone in a span of a year, Donna and Delilah, I had gone from being a community leader and a socialite to where I couldn't even stand to be in the presence of anyone who wasn't in the sex trade. I felt awkward. I felt out of place. And so you become very isolated. You know, you become very isolated. But it reached a time where I started to believe, and for the first time in many, many years, I was able to pray. And so it was nothing but God that delivered me. Now, I was tired of it, but I was powerless. I wanted to leave just like a lot of the women who worked for me. And in my book, I tell the story of a few of them who got out and how they got out. But you are powerless. I mean, you are really powerless.
Well, you know,
and your listeners might say, how can you be powerless? Well, if you've ever suffered from any kind of addiction, whether it's a chocolate addiction or whether it's a heroin addiction, you understand that sometimes you give your power away.
You give it over. Go ahead, Delilah. Did you want to ask?
I wanted to ask, first of all, you know, when you were in the midst of all of this, I'm assuming that you were making money hand over fist. You had a very lucrative business going on. According to your background, you had three different mansions, and you were running girls out of all three of them. Question is, how did you keep these girls there And then what happened to these girls after you went out of business?
Yeah.
Sure, sure. So let me clarify, I didn't have all three at the same time. During the Elliot Spitzer scandal, the Cleveland Plain Dealer discovered my operation and used my operation to gain access to females, and they ran a four-part expose. The deal was I had to get out of the business or else they would expose
you. Yes.
Uh-huh. So they believed I got out of the business. I actually got out of Cleveland but stayed in the business. And so the week that Elliot Spitzer resigned, they ran that four-part expose, and they referred to me what everyone in the sex industry referred to me as, and that's John at the Mansion. So after that, I set up a condo, and then I set up a place in Bloomfield Hills. So there were three different houses at three different times, all simultaneously, however. And so you ask, why did the girls stay? Well, they stayed for several reasons. They stayed for several reasons. Number one, it provided a sense of belonging that they never had before in their life. It was a sense of family, a sense of belonging, and a sense of value, and a sense of self-worth, albeit twisted and deceptive.
You were the most stable thing that they have had, is that right?
That is absolutely correct. That
right.
is absolutely correct.
Mm-hmm.
And then
that's
for the money, I mean, you know, they could just sit around. They didn't have to answer their own phone. They didn't have to negotiate or talk with customers. I would just basically say, okay, you've got a 10 o'clock. Okay, you've got 11 o'clock. You've got a 12 o'clock. You know, they go and service the customer and come back to my office, and there'd be an envelope waiting for them. So and
ultimately,
all
what happened to them afterwards? Did you try to help them, but in a healthy way, shall we say?
Yes, I still am in communication with a number of them, and when you read the book, most people who have sampled the book have a passion for Sasha. There's something about Sasha that touches their heart. And so, and she's the main character in the book. She was my quote-unquote partner at the mansion. She's the one I recruited to help me manage the females and manage the customers. And so she got into school at Cleveland State. For the first 2 years, she had a 4-point, and she wasn't taking basket weaving. She was taking math and science and calculus, and she was a very bright young lady. Unfortunately, her drug problem came back to haunt her, and her old boyfriend got out of prison and came back into her life, and so she's struggling now. But I maintain communication with a number of them. Some of them have got out. Most of them vacillate between in and out. They want out, but whenever they hit a rough patch, they find themselves back in, you know.
Uh-huh.
So,
yeah, it's kind of the nature of the beast, yeah.
Yes. And they're all waiting for me to go public, which I just made the decision last Friday that now it is the time for me to go public, because I believe that me going public and them seeing me and talking to me more and more, many of them will be delivered from that because they're tired of it. I recruited and cultivated 202 escorts during the time I was in business. And out of that 202, I'd say all but about 10 of them wanted out. I mean, all but about 10 of them wanted out. Now, when the camera's rolling and you stick a microphone, they're not going to tell you that. I mean, if you read even my comments to the Plain Dealer, it's a comment of disillusionment. You know, you're disillusioned because you have to put on this face that it's great. You know, nobody's going to put on the camera you know, and say, oh, you don't want to come here. You know, we're high all the time. Mm-hmm. We can't be sober because it's too painful. You know, we sleep with strangers that we don't know. You know, some of them smell good until they take off their clothes. And, you know, it's
right.
You know, they put on the glamorous face. They put on the glamorous
mm-hmm.
face.
Well, you know, in the last, we've got about 14 minutes or so. A couple things I want to talk about. Of course, we need to at least introduce, unfortunately, I guess, our friend Kelly did not make it to come on. Does there seem to be any call-ins from Kelly, Delilah?
No, I don't have any callers.
Well, okay, no other call. Okay. So we want John to be, number one is I want, before we leave, to want you to answer the question as to what is it that your goals are in the future? What is it that you're specifically charged with in your mind to help crime victims and to help these not necessarily that group that you worked on, but what is it that you are going to do from this point on to help crime victims or victims of trafficking so that they can
sure.
see that you are sincere and you have redeemed yourself, you are a changed man,
sure.
you are a reinvented person?
Yeah. Well, people who work with me know I'm sincere. They have absolutely no doubt about that. And to be quite honest with you, I'm really not concerned whether the public thinks I'm sincere or not. I have a specific mission. You know, before I became a born-again Christian in October of 2009, my
mm-hmm.
life was spent with top-level executives, powerful elected officials, and socialites. But
yep.
when I changed my life clear that my mission was for the underserved, the least of them. And so
mm-hmm.
what I'm doing today is very simple. I am working to set captives free. So those women and men who are trapped in the sex industry, who are addicted to drugs, who are addicted to fast money, that's who I have a message and a strategy for today. You know, so I hope that people understand I'm redeemed and I'm changed, but they're
mm-hmm.
not the ones who I need anyway. I need those people who are trapped. Those people who are held captive, and that's where my passion is.
And are different states or legislative bodies or corporations hiring you legitimately to do presentations at such as this conference, and is that how you're making your legitimate money now?
Well, remember, I just came out, so this is the first time I've ever talked publicly about my life in the sex trade. Most of my corporate folk from the past have no idea that I was ever in the sex trade. They know I disappeared. They don't know where I disappeared to. What
mm-hmm.
I've been doing for the past few years is working primarily with prison reentry. And here in Ohio, because of a lot of the hard work from a lot of good people, we're one of the leaders now in reducing our prison reentry. Men and women who are coming out are staying out, largely because of a lot of the programs. I'm chairing one program called Solutions, and the Solutions program over the past 3 years, the national recidivism rate is 67%. 67 out of 100 men and women go back to prison within 2 years. Our rate for people who come through our program is 7%,
mm-hmm.
only 7 out of 100. So that's
what
I've been doing. Now I'm turning my attention more so to sex trafficking and using some of those same strategies to pull women and men out of the sex trade, because I understand the hopelessness and I understand from a clinical sense how it has to happen. So what, and let me say this, there's a couple of things that we as a society has to do. One of the things I say to people, great civilizations fall one citizen at a time. Great civilizations
mm-hmm.
fall one citizen at a time. And sex trafficking disease that is on the rise in this country. And so one thing we have to do is understand that prostitution is not a victimless crime. The prostitutes were victimized in most cases, from the day they were born. So that's the first mm-hmm. thing we have to understand, and that's more than a cliche. So that's one of the things I will be doing, is explaining why prostitution is not a victimless crime. The second thing we have to do is make arresting offenders profitable. And I have strategies to do that. It has to be profitable right now because everyone says it's a victimless crime and there's no harm, no foul. The police, law enforcement's hands are tied in many cases. They can't justify spending the money and the man hours, the staff hours, to going after this. So we have to change that, and we have to make it profitable for local municipalities to be able to go after, you know. And then we've got to understand why she's selling it and why he's buying it. So that's
well,
what
John,
I'm out on the road to do.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt, but time's running down, and I do have a question. Now that you're starting into this new venture of yours, who are you partnering with anybody to basically to avoid duplication and reinventing the wheel? What resources are you using that are already in place and that are already working? Is there someone or some organization or something out there that you feel is has the resources that you need to be able to reach down in and do, and actually
and go,
get the things done
to
that you want
you,
done?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yes. So there are nearly enough organizations doing work. The only challenge is that they're underfunded and they don't have the business infrastructure to really produce. And so what I am doing is pulling together some of my old corporate friends, attorneys, CPAs, business developers, not-for-profit developers, and we're going to put together an incubator, and we're going to offer free services to, you know, the housewife or the survivor who's put together three or four women, and they're already out on the streets doing this work, but they don't have a board of directors. They don't have a development plan. They don't have a business plan, okay? So these are the things you need to really produce and be able to have results and capture those results so that they can be reproduced systemically. So I'm not trying to put together an organization that does programs. What I want to do is put together an organization that can provide the business structure to make organizations more effective, more efficient, and more productive.
So you're going to be helping, like, nonprofit organizations that are already pre-existing that assist with trafficking?
Yes, that's correct. For example, one of the organizations that is doing great work, and they're in North Carolina and Ohio, is Compassion to Act. But they are an emerging organization, so they don't know how to go out and form a board. You know, they don't have CPAs. They don't have development experts saying, okay, let's identify grants. Let's go out and pitch your story to business. So these are the things, and that's the biggest void that I see. So, you know, I'm not trying to put together an organization that initiates programs to rescue. What I want to do is provide a business infrastructure that makes the organizations we already have work effectively.
And have you approached your former colleagues for this? Have you gotten some positive feedback?
Yes, without question.
Good. Yeah. Well, you know, I would like you to mention, I can say a little bit briefly regarding this conference, because unfortunately Kelly didn't make it, I guess, and maybe you could fill in.
Sure.
The conference that you are going to be one of the main speakers,
sure,
at, presenters, is
April 4th.
The Area Health, Area Health Education Center Conference in Charlotte, Friday, April 4th, right?
Yes, April 4th from 8:30 to 4:30 at the Embassy Suites Hotel in Concord, North Carolina, right outside Charlotte.
Okay. And if people are interested, because there's still some time, how would they get in touch with the organizers?
Sure, sure. You can go to the AHEC website, or you can call. You can register to call, and that number is 704-512-6054. Again, 704-512-6054. That's the AHEC office, and AHEC is the host and presenter of this conference in Charlotte, North Carolina.
And what is their mission for this conference? What are they trying to accomplish? I know it's like the biggest one they try to do in Charlotte. What's the main purpose?
Education and solutions. You know, too often we tell stories because the stories are heart-wrenching, and in my case, I'm told it's fascinating and, you know, entertaining. But now we've got to move to solutions, you know. So
right.
Basically what I'm going to Charlotte to do is to provide some analyzation, some commentary, and some solutions, because that's where we are now. You know, stories are great, but stories don't change things.
Right. And with your various presentations, you have some unfortunately, we didn't get to a lot of, for example, you know, they're recruiting these high school and college students that are in middle class and upper class families. You say that is the most prolific segment, correct? Is there a can you give us a short explanation of what needs to be done to combat that in particular? And, you know, what do they do to groom a particular person like that? We've got about 3 minutes. Can you give us a short explanation?
Sure. Yeah. The first step is education. So let's understand what their strategy is, what is their method, how are they doing it. And so I'm going to lay it out very specifically and in detail what their strategies are, their anti-law enforcement strategies, how they're moving into residential neighborhoods. I will lay this out in great detail, but first we must understand what the enemy is doing before we can combat it. And right now there's a lot of ignorance to that. As I listen to a lot of activists, human trafficking activists talk, they're misinformed because, you know, they just don't know. Their hearts are in the right place. And so I say, however you feel about my past, at least listen to me, because I was an insider. You know, I was an insider. I helped write the book, you know. So, you know, judge me how you will, but at least listen to my facts and use them.
Right. And I, you know, I have to say we wish you all the best in trying to continue your public coming out process, because I think it can only help in a number of ways. People can take your words for what they can get out of them. I think you are doing this in all sincerity. At least I get that impression. And I think
I don't charge an appearance fee. I don't charge an appearance fee.
Well, good.
You know, they don't pay me for coming to North Carolina, or they won't pay me anywhere I go. So I don't charge an appearance fee. If I were in it for the money, I would have stayed, you know, in the escort business. So, anyone
understand.
Who thinks I'm in it for the money, if I were in it for the money, I would have stayed in the escort business.
Yeah. Now, can you give us I know there's a couple of excerpts regarding your Volume 1, Volume 2 books, and can you give us information about your website if people would like to learn more about you and your book?
Sure. Yes. JohnPace.org. That's JohnPace.org. JohnPace.org. Go there. They put the book on special for your listeners today. The book doesn't come out until September. And there's two volumes, Volume 1 and Volume 2, but they put an advanced copy edition and put a special price on it for your listeners. So if you go to my website, you can learn about me, johnpace.org. You can hear the presentation that I do. Why is she buying it? Why is he buying it? Why is she selling it in Prostitution 202, An Introduction to Sex Trafficking?
Wonderful. Well, it sounds very comprehensive. And so, unfortunately, our time is vast going away at this point in time. But, John, let's do keep in touch. I'll talk to you off air. And we wish you all the best in your future journeys. And, everyone, please stay tuned. We will have a detailed blog of this and embed the podcast for later listening. Thank you so much. We really appreciate
your
assistance.
Thank you, John.
And we'll all talk to you very soon, and we'll see you next Saturday for another episode of Shattered Lives. Good evening, everyone.